Well, welcome back, everyone. Really good to see you. This is the final in our series on four key words in John's Gospel and four key ideas or themes that run through that Gospel that we've done a series of four in a row. And before that, of course, we did a sort of special one on the prologue. So I'm going to try and do the fourth word and draw a little bit of what we've done together. And I'm going to try my very best to finish a little bit earlier than I normally do, and for us to have a bit of time to just reflect together, and for you to come back to me, and maybe not just on today, but on those of you that have been there before, on the way these words weave together. Because, of course, what I've done in taking my four words, which you remember are light, life, love, and glory, and today is going to be glory, I've, if you like, unpicked a little of a beautifully woven strand that runs through John, in which light, life, love and glory are all interwoven and are kind of aspects of one another, in order to show you the beauty of it, to show you the way it's run through and the consistency of it. But having, to borrow Keats's phrase, unwoven the rainbow briefly, we have to weave it back together again. And I hope that the benefit of all of this in the end will be not for you, as it were, vaguely just to remember the notes from those talks by Malcolm, but actually just to send you back with new eyes to John's Gospel and to read it as an ever richer and more extraordinary text. You may remember I started at the very beginning, those of you that were with me when I did the one on the prologue, by talking about the oldest bound book in the British Isles that we have, which is a copy of John's Gospel. And beautifully, beautifully written, still completely fresh and clear and legible today, which was the copy that was in the casket of St. Cuthbert, which has now been acquired for the British Museum. And so coming to John's Gospel with open eyes, recognising it as a deep well in which to dip, becoming aware of the extraordinary transformative power of the book itself, is part of a very long tradition, and will continue to be so. To the end of time, I think this gospel will give more and more. So we're just unpacking a little bit of it. So today, glory. And I'm going to do more or less a similar pattern to what I've done before. I'm going to try and look at what the word is in Greek and what the words behind it were. And then I'm going to look at the different ways it occurs and grows and develops within the gospel. And then, finally, I'm going to look at a bit of poetry that might give us a feel for what that glory means. And since I started with Cuthbert's Gospel, one of the glories of Anglo-Saxon England, the poem I'm going to do is a little bit of The Dream of the Rood, one of the other glories of Anglo-Saxon England, and that should give us a sense of the continuity of reading John's Gospel. But I want to start with a little encomium, almost a little hymn of praise for this word, this missing word, this word glory, which I think isn't used anything like enough in modern church discourse. It's almost as though we've fought shy of it. Glory sounds a little bit too triumphalistic and glorious, so we kind of backpedal on glory. But glory is a really key theme. So I'm going to read you from the remarkable book about the Creed, He Came Down from Heaven, which was written by Charles Williams, a great theologian, neglected theologian, about whom I've spoken in this very chapel. He was one of the Inklings. He was a great friend of and influence on C.S. Lewis. And he wrote a book called He Came Down from Heaven. And there's a chapter in it called The City, which is about co-inherence and exchange, about the way we all live from one another and ought to live delightedly knowing how interdependent we are. But in the course of it, he has this to say about glory, and this, as it were, sets a theme. So this is from his chapter, The City. The word that runs through the Bible, the word that defines the yonder side of the demanded caritas, typical Charles Williams phrase, that means this is the other side of love. The demanded caritas is the love, as we discussed it last week, the fullness of agape. Woven in the other side of love, as it were, every time you see the strand of love, you'll see this, in his opinion. The yonder side of the demanded caritas is glory. It is glory which in the Old Testament, from a general brightness, becomes a mathematical splendour. It is glory which accompanies in the New Testament the first beginning of signs, when water is suddenly poured out as wine. It is communicated to the disciples, the glory which thou gavest me, I have given them. It accompanies the city that slides from the utmost heavens into the sight of St. John on Patmos. In the Gospel of St. John, the word glory is particularly associated with action. It is the acts of Messiah which form the glory. The first miracle is his glory. He says to Martha just before the raising of Lazarus, in answer to her, Lord, by this time he stinketh, said I not unto thee that thou wouldest believe that thou shouldest see the glory of God? He promises the apostles, whatsoever ye shall ask in my name, that will I do, that the Father may be glorified in the Son. He looks forward to the passion. The hour is come that the Son of Man should be glorified. Father, save me from this hour, but for this cause came I unto this hour. Father, glorify thy name. The last discourse, that's that long, beautiful, last priestly prayer, as it's sometimes called in John. This is great. He says, the last discourse is a torrent of glory. The last prayer, a declaration of communicated glory, that is, of communicated acts. The pattern of the glory is a pattern of acts. Now, in the all that lovely outpouring from Charles Williams, even Charles Williams tended to go quite over the top in the way he spoke. In fact, after an evening with Charles Williams once at the Eagle and Child, J.R.R. Tolkien wrote a letter to his son. He said, we had more clotted glory from Charles. But if out of all that clotted glory from the wonderful Charles Williams, you only remember one phrase, remember this, the pattern of the glory is a pattern of acts. Beautiful sound, actually. The pattern of the glory is a pattern of acts. What I think he's suggesting by that is that there is one glory, the glory that is with God, that is with the Son, the glory of heaven. That this glory is fully in Christ and comes to earth, and that John's Gospel is all about seeing that glory. But the way we see the glory is as pattern. At certain key moments, as it were, the veil is drawn aside or something glints through. And if we take all those points in John's Gospel where we get the word glory or we get the connection of glory, we will see a pattern. And that pattern is a pattern of acts. The glory is not about moments when, as it were, Jesus is doing nothing in particular and standing about the place so we can all look at his glory. The glory, it's quite the reverse. The glory is disclosed when he is doing, when he's making water into wine, when he's raising Lazarus, when he is about to give himself totally to everyone in an open gift. This is all of me for all of you, when he chooses, consciously chooses the cross. It's at the moment, as we'll see shortly, that Judas goes out to betray him, and he knows that he's about to be betrayed. And the last paragraph, as it were, of the gospel has finished with those chilling words, and it was night. At that darkest moment, that is the point at which Jesus suddenly says, now the hour has come for the Son of Man to be glorified. And we see the glory coming. So the pattern of the glory is a pattern of acts. I just wanted to kind of highlight that. So a nice little bit from Charles Williams, which I hope gives you a flavour of the way in which there is a pattern to be discerned and there is something to be drawn out of contemplating the word glory and the idea of glory in John. So how are we going to do that? Well, as before, I've tried to look at what's happening with the Greek word. Now, the Greek word that's used for glory in John is the word doxa. Doxa, and it's doxa is, as it were, the noun glory, and it's related to a whole series of verbs, dokeo, doxatso, to glorify, dokeo means to believe, and so on. And there's some wonderful words. There's a special word for sharing in glory. Syndoxatso, wonderful, sin together. It's like synergy or synchronicity. It's sin gloriness. I don't mean sin with an error. I mean S-Y-N. So there's a whole pattern of words, but their root is doxa. Now, when I got to do some New Testament Greek as a theological student, and John's Gospel was my special set text, so I kind of came across this word quite quickly because it's right there as a keynote. You know, I explained how the prologue is almost like the overture to an opera. The main themes, the key words, life, light, love and glory are all set out in different ways in the prologue and then developed in the Gospel. And in the prologue, we have John 1, 14, perhaps the most powerful verse in the whole. The reason why the Gospel was written was this verse, was, "And the Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory," then repeated again, "the glory as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth." Well, when I was reading this in my New Testament Greek, and I came across, therefore, for the first time, puzzling it out, this word, doxa, for glory, I was actually puzzled and quite shocked at what had become of this word. Because I had had a little encounter with Greek before. I'd done a little bit of classical Greek. And then when I had become really interested in philosophy, and particularly in Plato and Aristotle, I had, albeit with lots of helps and cribs, I had struggled with a bit of the Greek, of the Platonic dialogues. And I had come across the word doxa in a BC, a long way BC, pagan philosophical context. And doxa, as Plato used it, meant belief or opinion. And Plato contrasts people's doxa, people's what people think is the case, with what he was trying to achieve through a bit of rigorous philosophy, which was episteme. Episteme was proper philosophical knowledge of a subject. So doxa was your opinion, what you think, you know, your view. And I was very surprised. I thought, how can that have anything to do with the true glory of the Godhead? Surely that's not at all about images or opinions. Something must have happened to this word. And indeed, something had. And it was fascinating for me, actually, in preparing this talk for you, to get a little sense of the journey that this word doxa had been on. And in fact, what becomes of it, first in the Septuagint, which I mentioned to you is the Greek version of the Old Testament, and then in the whole of the New Testament, is a fascinating story of how, to me, it's one of the evidences of the resurrection, actually. When you get a powerful new experience, a powerful new reality coming into the world, people are almost, as it were, having their consciousness moved or shifted, or you get a new body of knowledge. This is true in science as well, when you get a whole new area of understanding. Something has to happen to language. Either you have to have completely new words, which, for example, scientists quite often make, or you have to take an old word that everybody thought they knew, and you have to expand it more and more till it almost breaks and it becomes full of a new meaning. You can see that going on in lots of ways. If you actually think about what Newton did to the word gravity, for example. I mean, the word gravity was already there. But gravity is this hidden, balanced, beautifully calibrated thing that was balancing all things, was not there. But his new understanding took an old word and gradually filled it in a new way. And that's what happened to doxa. Essentially, doxa originally meant to believe or to think. Then, in the philosophical schools, it came to generally mean appearances, the appearance of things. But then when the philosophers had dropped it and people had started using it more generally, it began to change a little bit. And in ordinary speech, just the way people would use it, because it meant image or appearance, it actually began to mean reputation or how you were seen. Image in the other sense, how you're accounted for. And then gradually it began to be used a little bit to mean to be of good repute, to be seen well, to convey outwardly and visibly a bit of the heart of who you are, and to have that outward image, as it were, acclaimed. It was beginning to get those senses by the time Jewish people in the diaspora, realizing that third, fourth, fifth generation Jews living across the Greek-speaking world, who hadn't ever been or might have only been once a year to Israel, were going to need have their scriptures in their common language, which was sort of Demotic Greek. So when they began to make this translation of the Septuagint, they decided to use this word, which had now become something like appearance, repute, worth, visible weight and importance and gravitas, okay? They decided to use that word, doxa, to translate a really, really key Hebrew word, which means much, much more than that. It could be seen to mean something a little bit like that, but it means much, much more. And that Hebrew word was kavod. I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right. Are there any Hebrew? I'm in Cambridge. There must be somebody who knows how to pronounce Hebrew. Any classical Hebraists around? Kavod, I think, probably. Kavod, which means glory. But the original root meaning of kavod is weight. Weight, solidity, strength, substance, you know, dense reality. Okay, that's what kavod is about, the kavod of God. And that's what Paul, who knows both the Hebrew and the Greek, is punning on in Corinthians when he talks about the eternal and exceeding weight of glory. He's kind of putting the weight, the gravitas, the momentum back into glory. So that's one word that was used. Another word that was often associated with kavod, and often they're used in pairings together, is Shekinah. Shekinah is the shining splendor of the presence. Now, Shekinah's root as a Hebrew word is to dwell with. And for the late Hebrew people, what we call the intertestamental period, those two words, kavod and Shekinah, were almost like personified aspects of God, his glory, his weight, his presence, his shining, luminous presence. Now, just to give you an idea of some uses of kavod, which then was translated when the Old Testament was translated into Greek, for which the word doxa was used, because now, to understand why and when John uses doxa, I now have to completely ditch my Plato and think that he's not talking about opinion versus true knowledge. He's talking about something else. Now, what is that something else? Well, here's just some little glimpses I've given them on the handout. Psalm 19, verse 1. The heavens declare the glory of God. The firmament showeth forth his handiwork. So the glory and splendor of the stars shining luminously up there are just like an outer hint of the kavod, the weight of glory of God, okay? So kavod is the word that's used for glory there. Then, now this is an extraordinary theme, and I think it's very important for our understanding of the way glory is used in John. So in the Septuagint, the word for the heavens declare the glory of God is the doxa of God. Now, let's go back into Exodus, and let's think about those extraordinary moments. I've alluded to them already, where Moses goes up onto the mountain and talks with God, and the splendor of God is coming, and he says, I can't look on the face of God and live. No man can look at this. And remember, he hides in the cleft of the rock, and he sees, as it were, God's hinder parts. And even that, as it were, kind of looking away from the backward parts, as it were, of the trailing cloud of glory, is enough almost to transfigure Moses. And when he comes down from the mountain, his face is shining, and it has to be veiled. And St. Paul thinks a lot about that and what that means. And of course, we get that experience repeated in a very powerful way to understand who Jesus is and how the glory of God dwells in him when we have a mountaintop experience in the Gospels and we have the Mount of Transfiguration. And guess who is there? Moses and Elijah, the two guys who had the same mountaintop experience of, and here we're using the word Shekinah, the Shekinah glory presence of God. And some interpreters would say it's the same mountaintop experience that what they see, if you like, because before Abraham was, I am, is they see for a moment the shining splendor of the I am who was made flesh. on the mountain. So if you like, Moses is climbing the mountain BC and Elijah is climbing the mountain post Moses, and Jesus, Peter, James and John are climbing the mountain just as it were AD, but they actually all meet ultimately at some confluence, some point where the acts and the pattern of glory, the threads all cross, and they see that. So you remember you had the mountaintop experience, but then you remember, and this is really amazing and almost quite frightening, when you, frightening in a good way if you like, awesome, fearful, when you go on to read in Exodus, you remember they sent Moses up the mountain and saying, well, you know, you deal with that stuff, we don't want the glory, you know, it's wonderful but slightly frightening, you know, these mountaintop experiences. As long as he stays up on the mountaintop, we'll be all right. But you remember, of course, when the other place where the Shekinah shone forth, the burning bush, God had said to Moses, I've heard the cry of my people, I will come down. A promise that for Christians would see as ultimately fulfilled in the manger at Bethlehem. But I will come down. And in Exodus, what happens is, remember, they're instructed to make the tabernacle, the tent of meeting. Guess what the verb for dwell is when we say the word was made flesh and dwelt with us? It's based on the same word tabernacle and the word that's used when it's translated. So it's that he tabernacled with us. So there's a kind of connection there. Let's just look at this bit in Exodus 40 from 34. Sorry, I didn't give you that it was chapter 40. Then a cloud covered the tent of the congregation, and the glory of the Lord, the Kavoth, filled the tabernacle. And Moses was not able to enter into the tent of the congregation, because the cloud abode thereon, and the glory of the Lord filled the tabernacle. And when the cloud was taken up from over the tabernacle, the children of Israel went onwards in all their journey. But if the cloud was not taken up, then they journeyed not till the day that it was taken up. For the cloud of the Lord was upon the tabernacle by day, and the fire was on it by night, in the sight of all the house of Israel throughout all their journeys. Very powerful, this accompanied journey, when the glory fills the place. It's almost like a kind of physical splendor that you can scarcely approach, okay? And the word for all of that, that whole Exodus passage in the Septuagint, this wonderful Greek translation, is doxa. So when the writer of John takes up the pen and says, we beheld his doxa, we beheld the doxa of God, and we beheld it in the face. Jesus Christ, he's really saying something. Very powerful. So, glory is a pretty central theme, as we'll see in John. I've already quoted, as it were, the preliminary, if you like, summary before you start of what they saw. The word was made flesh and tabernacled amidst us, and we beheld his doxa, the doxa as of the only begotten of the Father, full of grace and truth. There's a wonderful word, that Greek word there as well, pleroma, full, fullness, overflowing. But that's, if you like, a kind of summary of everything. What's really interesting when you look at the pattern in John is the way the glory comes in John. It's not, as it were, revealed all at once. There are certain moments at which glory happens, or there is glorifying. And at first it's almost like a kind of curtain twitched aside, and it's almost, there's a sense of anticipation and a sense of timing. And you get that in that really quite strange, but now I think, if you want to think about the glory and what this means, explicable now, encounter in the wedding at Cana with his mother. When, you know, there's a kind of domestic supply of wine party issue going on here, and Jesus has shown up with his disciples, and maybe that upset the balance of the numbers a little bit, and would be great shame on the family if they didn't get the catering right. And you remember Mary goes up to Jesus and says, they have no wine, hint, hint. And it's awful. Gunai, he says in Greek, woman, which is actually quite rude. Woman, what hast thou to do with me? Mine hour is not yet come. And in the shaping of John's gospel, that's a great moment. Mine hour. Now, if somebody says at the beginning of the book, not yet, that sets you up, doesn't it, for anticipation. When? you get a series of not yet. So you're waiting for a now, and you'll see where we get it. And we get it almost at the most unexpected moment. So, my now is not yet come. But, of course, he then... It's very interesting. I looked again at the text. There's no moment at which he says, okay, mum, fair enough. He just says, my now is not yet come. But she then immediately turns to the servants and says, do whatever he tells you. And, of course, then he tells them to draw the water. And they bring the water to the master of the feast. And it's become wine. And what does John, the evangelist, say at the end of recounting this? He does not use the word miracle. He doesn't use the word miracle at all, actually, in his gospel. All of his miracles are referred to as sema, signs. They all mean something. They're telling you something. So in John 2:11, this beginning of miracles, it's been in this translation, but it's signs, actually, sema, did Jesus in Cana of Galilee and manifested forth his glory. And his disciples believed on him. So it wasn't just a kind of thing for the party. Something was shown. Now, to know what that glory is and what it meant, we will have to come in the end to the cross, which we'll see is where the glory is truly, truly manifest. And of course, that was the point about the wine. The wine was a sign. The wine would ultimately be a sign of the blood that he shed, his true life, the sign of his love, the light coming out of him. That's the first bit. And then we get a series of other moments throughout John, and you can have fun with a concordance one day and trace them through. And you'll see that when you do that, that as Charles Williams says, the pattern of the glory is a pattern of acts. This is an act of compassion, an act of provision, an act of transformation. In fact, it was an act which revealed the whole meaning of what he was going to do, because not only did the wine suggest in the end the Last Supper and communion, but if you remember, what were the pots of water for? Do you remember? The 6 stone jars. They were for ritual purification. They were for acts of outer washing. So to take the very thing that was meant for the act of outer washing and say the outer is now to become inner, the outward rituals and gestures and features of the religion are now to be turned into something which makes glad the heart of man and is within, is an almost exact parallel to what he's going to do in the next, a couple of chapters later, with the woman at the well, who wants to do all the outer stuff with the actual well, and this is Jacob's well, and which mountain should we worship on? And he's about to transform that completely and say, I'll give you a fountain within, welling up. So there's a whole beginning of the movement where in the end, of course, at the total glory moment in that long torrent of glory, as Charles Williams calls it in the final discourse, he starts saying, I and the Father are one, may be one, as I am the Father and one, as I am in the Father and he is in me, so I will be in you. By the end, he's taken the whole glory, the unapproachable kabod, the weight, the dwelling with, the Shekinah of God, and has said, if you want to look for it now, if you're in me and I'm in you, it's in here. And not just in here privately for you, it's in there, it's in your neighbour. It's in the bread and wine. It's going to shine out at any point. It's the vision that will eventually lead a poet like Gerard Manley Hopkins to be able to say the world is charged with the grandeur of God, the glory of God. It will shine out like shaking from shook foil, you know. There's something, as it were, glorious and of God right at the core of things, not just at some unimaginable beyond of things. I will come down, said God to Moses. And Moses probably thought a cloud in the tent of meeting was about as close as you're going to get. He was wrong. It was going to be much more, as it were, up close and personal than that. So we can't, especially if I'm going to leave some time for discussion, we can't go through every bit of the pattern. So I want to go to the moment when there are 2 points in chapter 12 and 13, and it's really the same moment, where he says, the hour is come. And then he says, now is the time coming. It's chapters 12 and 13, okay? And it's a very, very interesting scenario. Let me just... this is a wonderful, handy thing I actually get to have. My John and my Greek. That's all here, which is lovely. So... an extraordinary thing happens. Round about, Philip has come with Andrew and a couple of Greeks who've said, we want to see Jesus. And this is particularly significant in John's Gospel, because although John's Gospel is certainly written by somebody who was there in Palestine and who knew it, and it's got lots of details that come out of Jewish and Aramaic things, nevertheless, it is equally clearly written by somebody who wants to make it clear to the Greeks. And that's why you get the preface about the Logos. Philip cometh and telleth Andrew, and again Andrew and Philip tell Jesus. Jesus answered them, saying, the hour is come that the Son of Man should be glorified. What do they make of that? Well, Jesus goes on to say this, and this is the shocking thing. Verily, verily, I say unto you, except a corn of wheat fall into the ground and die, it abideth alone. But if it die, it bringeth forth much fruit. He that loveth his life shall lose it, but he that hateth his life in this world shall keep it unto life eternal. If any man serve me, let him follow me, and where I am, there also my servant shall be. If any man serve me, him will my Father honour. Now, this is where we have a problem with translations. The AV is giving us honour, but actually the verb is related to doxa. So it's actually, my Father will glorify. Then we get what is effectively John's version of the agony in the garden. John actually presents early at this point, just before Judas goes out, a kind of agonizing moment for Jesus. Now is my soul troubled, and what shall I say? Father, save me from this hour, but for this cause I came unto this hour. Father, glorify, that verb from doxa, thy name. And then, and this is really remarkable, you not only get your Gethsemane moment, but you get a kind of reprise of the baptism, the parting of the heavens, the apparent sound of thunder, the moment of his total vocation, the moment at which God had said, this is my beloved, in whom I am well pleased. Father, glorify thy name. Then came there a voice from heaven saying, I have both glorified it and will glorify it again. The people therefore that stood by and heard it said that it thundered. Others said an angel spake to him. Jesus answered and said, this voice came not because of me, but for your sakes. Now is the judgment of the world. Now shall the prince of the world be cast out. And I, if I be lifted up from the earth, will draw all men unto thee, unto me. Now that's pretty extraordinary. We know, and probably some but not all of the disciples could guess by this time, what the Greeks made of it, I don't know, that he was talking about the cross. That when I am lifted up, then I will be drawing all men to me. And he makes it clear that he's talking about the cross because he talks about the agony and because he says, unless a grain of wheat falls into the ground. He actually sets out the principle of death and resurrection, then says, now is the hour. Now, why is this so shocking? Why would this have been so totally mind-blowing to those around him? Well, it's because of the phrase he uses at the beginning of this bit of this discourse, which again maybe needs a little bit of background. What he actually says is, the hour is come, going back to verse 23, the hour is come that the Son of Man should be glorified. Now, the Son of Man was not just an idle phrase, and it wasn't simply a euphemism for being human. Sometimes we've tended to contrast the two phrases that are sometimes used in the Gospel about Jesus, the Son of Man and the Son of God, as a way of talking about his humanity and his divinity. And that's quite interesting and useful, because it's true that he's human and true that he's divine, and those are nice phrases. But to do that and use the Son of Man as if it was just a general phrase that meant human, it did mean human, is to miss something really important. And that something really important is in the book of Daniel. And the book of Daniel was a very, very big book at the time. There's a whole bunch of intertestamental literature, as it's called, like the book of Enoch, which we don't officially have, but which was around, which are all, if you like, riffing on the book of Daniel. Now, the book of Daniel is a very strange book, but there is an extraordinary picture of heaven and of a heavenly view of the conflicts of earth represented by various beasts and animals, which eventually are all destroyed. And then there is a description of the coming of one like unto the Son of Man. Let me just read you. This is Daniel 7, 13 and 14. I haven't given it on the sheet, but you can check it out. I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man coming with the clouds of heaven. Do you remember the clouds? The cloud is the symbol of the presence of the glory of God, the Shekinah. And you know, remember that phrase is on Jesus' lips in some of the other gospel accounts of his trial. You will not see me again until you see the Son of Man coming. Yeah. So this is all in Daniel in the Old Testament. I was watching in the night visions, and behold, one like the Son of Man, coming with the clouds of heaven. He came to the Ancient of Days, and they brought him near before him. Then to him was given dominion and glory, doxa, and a kingdom. Do you remember Jesus talks constantly about the kingdom? That all peoples, nations, and languages should serve him. His dominion is an everlasting dominion which shall not pass away, and his kingdom one that shall not be destroyed. Now that prophecy in Daniel, coming as it does after a description of a whole bunch of horrible animals that represent, and we're told they represent, kings and dominions and political systems and oppressions and invasions, all of those are suddenly cleared away, and this figure comes before the Ancient of Days, before the God of Israel, one like unto the Son of Man, full of glory. And the Ancient of Days says, right, I am now going to give you the dominion and the glory, and your rule shall be an everlasting rule. That was an absolutely key messianic prophecy. And it was linked with all the promises to David, and that one of David's line would sit on the throne and judge forever. It was linked to all the prophecies in Isaiah, and the government shall be upon his shoulders, and his name shall be called Wonderful Counselor, Mighty God, Prince of Peace. Now, for a minute, we've got to just willingly suspend or put to one side the way we interpret that now. We interpret it now because we have John's Gospel and we know what the light of the cross and the resurrection was about. Just, if you were an oppressed Jewish person, you know, who'd been first under the heel of the Greeks and then under the heel of the Romans, and then if you go back before that, under the heel of the Persians, and then before that, under the heel of the Babylonians. And yet you know, you're called and you know the God of glory, and your nation is called to the God of glory, and you have a promise that one day one will come, the Son of Man, who will actually be given the glory and dominion, and he will announce the kingdom, and it will be the kingdom of God, and the kingdom of God will begin, and you will wait till the hour comes. And when the hour comes for the glory to be revealed, then your troubles are over. Then he will just have to stand up and shine out. And just like they couldn't go into the tent of the presence because of the Shekinah, when that Shekinah shines out, when that glory is there, then the legion of the Romans will be cast out. Then, you know, the great days will come when people will come from far away and load their camels with other people's good. And there's a kind of fantasy of the oppressed people to have like total world dominion for all time, under the incredible Son of Man, okay? And that's why it was so key, politically and in every other way, to check out the pretenders to who is going to be the Son of Man. And that's why the people who were actually in charge, whether they were Herod or Caesar, were quite upset by anybody making the claim to be this person, because if they got a bit of a popular wave behind them, you know, we could have trouble. So this question of my hour is not yet come, when is my hour going to come, what am I going to say? Everybody's on the edge of their seat. So when he says, you know, in John 12, the hour is come that the Son of Man should be glorified, everybody's going, yes! And then he talks about dying and letting go and falling into the ground and talks about other people following him to the cross. And he completely changes and shows in its fullest the understanding of who the Son of Man is. Yes, he is the Son of Man. Yes, indeed, Isaiah was right, that in the Son of Man, the Lord will bear his mighty arm. And everybody thought that meant roll up your sleeve and crush the other nations. Actually, it meant he will bear his own mighty arm on the cross. And he will defeat not this evil empire or that evil empire or this death dealer or that death dealer. He will defeat evil and death itself. He will reverse it all. He will bring to us and through him to all a life that overcomes that. And he will do that, all of that, by entirely giving himself, by choosing to suffer, by taking it all in. This, and John is saying, now that is glory. That's where the glory is. And that's why when it goes on into the next chapter in 13, I've said here, but he's still picking up. By the way, in 12:31, now is the judgment of the world. Now shall the prince of the world be cast out. It's really key. He's reading Daniel for you. And he's saying, this is what's going to happen. I'm not overthrowing the pretensions of one petty princeling or another. I'm showing the whole of humanity forever a totally new path and a way in which evil will be overcome. And the light will shine in the darkness and the darkness will never overcome it. It's all being revealed here. So then if we go into John 13, this is amazing. We get that line I mentioned already. Judas makes the decision to betray him. He goes out and it was night. And then that's verse 30. That's 13 verse 30. Then 13 verse 31. Therefore, when he was gone out, Jesus said, now is the Son of Man glorified, and God is glorified in him. If God is glorified in him, God shall also glorify him in himself and shall straightway glorify him. That's really important. Straightway glorify him. It's not like I'm going to have to go through this, you know, depressing stuff on the cross, but don't worry, there'll be some wonderful kingdom someplace else. He's actually saying the glory is here. And that's a key theme in understanding suffering and a key theme in understanding Christian martyrdom and, you know, what Stephen sees when he's being stoned. He sees the glory. So that's quite extraordinary. And then is this glory, as it were, private? Well, later on in John 17, the torrent of glory, as Charles Williams called it. I've just given you a little taste of it. These words spake Jesus and lifted up his eyes to heaven and said, Father, the hour is come. Again, this is the third chime of the hour. This happens three times. The hour is come, the hour is come, the hour is come. The hour is come. Glorify thy Son, that thy Son may glorify thee. That's also something which we have hardly time to go into, but it's one of the acts of the glory. All of these are acts. Is that there is always an exchange of glory. Actually, Jesus never glorifies himself. He's always giving glory to the Father. And the Father's giving glory to him. And he actually then gives glory to his disciples, who give glory to him. And this, he actually, one of his woes in this is, woe if you glorify yourself. You know, he specifically says, I do not glorify myself. And this is a fundamental principle, as Charles Williams would say, of exchange and coherence. And if we got this, we would live in a very different society. That actually, our glory does not come from private achievement and private self-image and boosting ourselves up a little bit more and constantly repeating our own private mantra that every day in every way I'm getting better and better. It actually consists of losing ourselves, setting ourselves aside, doing something loving in particular for someone else. And in the very act of doing that, lifting the other person up, the other person looks back and perceives glory. We don't perceive it. We perceive glory in other people. And the glory, it runs back and forth in an exchange, but is never, as it were, self-generated. It's a part of the perichoresis. It's part of the exchange of glory. That's why you get the thrice holy in the angels and they're always giving glory. Glory is one of these things that you can't keep. It's kind of, as I mean, one theologian rather prosaically describes that hot potato. You know, you're kind of constantly sort of passing it round. So, if God be glorified, he shall be glorified straight away. Then look at this final thing. The Son of Man may also glorify thee, as thou hast given him power over all flesh, that he should give eternal life to as many as thou hast given him. And this is eternal life, that they might know thee, the only true God, and Jesus Christ whom thou hast sent. I have glorified thee on earth. I have finished the work which thou gavest me to do. And now, O Father, glorify thou me with thine own self, with the glory which I had with thee before the world was. So that's that check in our. Then, 17:22, and the glory which thou gavest me, I have given them, that they may be one, even as we are one. So it's in Exodus, you start with the glory, the kavod, the Shekinah, up there. Then you get it in a tent of meeting. And basically nobody goes near the tent of meeting because the glory is there. In John, the glory comes into Jesus. And it's only revealed at the moments when Jesus is in the act of giving to others. And is fully and finally revealed in the act of total self-giving on the cross. And then because of that, is loosed into the world and shines out in people in the moments of self-giving. And that's why particularly in the early church, the martyrs were felt to be, as it were, the very channels of glory, because they were supremely giving at that point. So it's a quite extraordinary it's a kind of subversion of an old idea of glory, and it's a kind of reimagining of a new glory, and it's a witness in the end to something extraordinary. And we've kind of, I think, somehow lost this word. We've somehow backpedaled on it. We're a bit shy of using it, perhaps because when we say the word glory, we think of some form of triumphalism, some sort of glory, glory, hallelujah, some sort of I'm great, you know. I mean, I suppose we did. We subverted the word we English, didn't we, when we wrote Land of Hope and Glory, Mother of the Free. This is kind of one of the most ironic lines ever written. But setting that aside, that's a false worldly glory of acquisition. Glory in John always flows at the moment of costly self-giving. It's just at the moment of self-emptying, of setting aside, that the glory comes. That's where the glory is. The glory which thou gavest me, I have given them. There's an extraordinary idea that glory, the person who gets that and realizes the radical truth that the kavod, the weight of glory, is now in here, is St. Paul. And I'm only doing on John, so I'm not allowed to stray on to St. Paul, but briefly, Romans 8, I consider the suffering of the present time is not to be compared with the glory that is to be revealed in the children of God. Or the amazing passage in 2 Corinthians 4, 15 to 18. For all things are for your sakes, that the grace being multiplied through the many may cause thanksgiving to abound unto glory. This is grace flowing from people to people, and everybody, every new person who gets it, gives it some, and there's a kind of a multiplying of glory and grace. Wherefore we faint not, though, I love this, though our, so the may cause of thanksgiving to abound unto the glory of God. Wherefore we faint not, for though our outward man is decaying, believe me, yet our inward man is renewed every day, day by day. For our light affliction, which is for the moment, worketh for us more and more exceedingly an eternal weight of glory. He's punning on kavod, weight, but using doctor. While we look not at the things which are seen, but at the things which are unseen, for the things which are seen are temporal, the things that are unseen are eternal. There's an amazing bit in one of John Donne's sermons where he says, how am I going to... He says this light affliction, weight of glory, how do I work that out? And Donne sees implicit in that, I don't know if it's in Paul's mind or not, but Donne summons up the image of a scale, and he has this fantastic... bit where he's going on for about an entire paragraph of sort of John Donne's bad hair day. I mean, just goes through all the crushing, miserable, horrible, you know, just weighing him down and down and down and down. And you just think there's no way out of this. You know, I didn't realise you could express so clearly how miserable life can get. Quite extraordinary. And then he goes, the Lord of hosts himself, the Almighty God himself, the Almighty God himself only knows the weight of this affliction. And except he put in that pondus gloriae, that exceeding weight of an eternal glory, with his own hand, in the other scale, we are weighed down. We are swallowed up irreparably, irrecoverably, irrevocably, irredeemably. That's John Donne, etc., etc. But isn't that a wonderful idea? That God alone knows the weight I'm carrying. And it's good. I'm not accepting anything from anybody else. God himself must put into the other scale with his own hand this pondus gloriae, as he puts it in Latin, this eternal exceeding weight of glory. So anyway, that's a glimpse of glory. I'm going to just read you a tiny bit of the Dream of the Rood, and then I'm going to draw stumps. Why the Dream of the Rood? It's a great Anglo-Saxon poem, which is about a vision of the cross. And we have it on a stone cross in runes and in one manuscript. And we also have it, which is the key thing here, we have two or three lines of it on a tiny silver reliquary, also in runes, which was found in Monastery in Italy. And it's clear that this little reliquary was meant to contain, and perhaps did contain, you know, a fragment of the true cross. So it was the wood, you know, the stained wood of the cross, covered over in silver. Now, what this guy did, this poet who wrote the poem, which somebody then had the sheer brilliance to put on this reliquary, was to totally reverse it and say, no. The glory is when you see the stains of the wood coming through. And he has this poem to the cross. In the end, in the poem, the cross itself speaks. He has the vision of the... And it's a challenge to the vision. I believe it's a direct challenge to the vision of the cross that Constantine saw at the Battle of Milvian Bridge in 315, when Constantine, you remember, was suddenly converted, in inverted commas, to Christianity, which meant that he basically took the eagles off the top of his soldiers' things and stuck a Cairo on there and then just proceeded merrily to the slaughter and called it Christianity. I don't think it was any kind of conversion at all, but there you go. And it starts off with this vision of the cross in the sky, which is what Constantine claimed he saw. And then it really shows where the actual glory is, which is in this totally self-giving love, this agape from the light and life. So here's a bit. It's translated into mainly by Helen Gardner with little bits by me from the Anglo-Saxon. It seemed to me I saw the strangest of trees lifted aloft in the air, when I am lifted up, with light all around it. Of all beams the brightest, it stood as a beacon, drenched in gold, gleaming gems were set fair round its foot, five such flamed high upon its cross branch, hosts of angels gazed upon it in world without end glory. This was no felon's gallows. Holy souls in heaven hailed it with wonder, and mortal men on earth and all the Maker wrought. Strange was that tree of triumph, and I, a transgressor stained by my sins, I saw the tree of glory. Yet, beneath the gold, I glimpsed the signs of some ancient agony, when again, as of old, its right side sweated blood. Sorrow seized me. I was full of fear. I saw the beacon flicker, now dazzling, now darkened, at times drenched and dripping, running red with blood, at times a royal treasure. Now that is Johannine vision, the two together like that. And it's almost cinematic kind of effect, isn't it? To see the glory in and through the blood and sweat. That's not only a vision that John's given us and a vision that's unique in Christ. I actually think that is a true vision. And I think when you're with people who are giving in love with blood, sweat and tears, you see glory. And when you see people pouring out love as they're dying, you see glory. That's when, and that is real glory, the real glory of God, the actual love of God, not out there, but in here, shining out of them. And that's the vision of glory that I think John saw. And that's what John meant at the beginning of his gospel, says, we beheld his glory, glory as of the only begotten. I'm going to stop right now. And let's just have any responses people want to either this about glory, or if you want to cast your minds back and think maybe about the links, we've had light and life and love and now glory. Thank you very much for coming and for listening, and we'll sort of, that's over to you now.